Welcome to the 10th episode of Law and Religion Down Under. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. This bi-monthly podcast is devoted to exploring the myriad of ways that law and religion can interact. Each episode of Law and Religion Down Under features an interview with a different guest drawn from across the spectrum of religions and ideologies. Our question for today is what the history of the relationship between law and religion in Australian history can tell us about the present and perhaps even the future. We'll talk about religion in colonial Australia, how the relationship stood at the time of Federation, and about how demographic changes have affected the religious affiliation of Australians in recent decades. My guest today is Dr. Joanna Cruickshank, a senior lecturer at Deakin University. Joanna specializes in history and has written extensively about the role of religion in Australia. Her recent article, Religious Freedom in the Most Godless Place Under Heaven, Making Policy for Religion in Australia, appears in the journal History Australia. Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
So I guess my first question is the sort of question that every high school student taking a history course might ask: why does this matter? Why do we have to learn this stuff? How would you answer that question about why knowing the history of religion and the state in Australia has value today?
Sure. Well, history always makes everything better. So that's an important principle to start with. But I think in this instance, particularly, history gives us a kind of a broader and a longer perspective on these questions. And that's particularly the case, I think, if we don't just look at the history of the relationship between law and religion narrowly conceived. So on the one hand, I think looking at that history helps us to see that these are really long-standing tensions that we are seeing reemerge in perhaps a slightly different form in the present. But they've got long, deep roots. They're not superficial challenges. I think is what history would teach us. The second thing, which might seem a little bit counterintuitive, is that I think history can help us to pay attention to things that are important but are not actually being considered in the current controversy. So I think there are aspects of these debates that are not obvious when we just focus on how they're being construed, how they're being understood in this present moment from this present perspective.
Okay. And what are some of the misconceptions, I guess, that you would find generally about what people know or don't know or think they know, but they're mistaken about when it comes to the history in this area?
I haven't done any official surveying work on this. Sure. So I'm pretty much going on reading the comments sections of news media sites, which is not a great idea.
But
it is dangerous. Yeah. You're not meant to do it. But it is quite enlightening on this kind of matter. And I think there's two notions which in some ways are quite opposed to each other that I see coming up again and again. The first is the notion that Australia is a secular country, and I think that often contains the idea that there is some kind of legally enshrined separation of religion and government in Australia. Often the notion that secularism has been kind of hard won against a sort of historical context of religious fundamentalism or religious influence, that's at some point Australia emerged as a secular country with secular laws, and often that idea is used to warn against what's seen as a kind of encroaching influence of religion at present. The other idea that I would see coming from usually from a different angle is the notion that there are strong protections for religion and religious freedom in Australia. And sometimes I think, as with many other things, the terms of the debate, the understanding of how the relationship between law and religion has formed, has been taken from very prominent debates in somewhere like the US. And there's an assumption that somehow Australia is a parallel or similar context. Now, obviously, both those ideas that Australia is secular, that there are religious freedoms, both of those ideas do actually contain some truth. They do contain some truth about the relationship between law and religion, but I don't think they really do justice to the complexity of that relationship.
I think your reference to the United States is a really apt one here, because that's something I found in teaching constitutional law, is a lot of students think we have a Bill of Rights, just like the United States Constitution has, and maybe they also think that there's a wall of separation between church and state, as you know, some people think the U.S. has here in Australia. But it's interesting, too, you say that there's also the flip sort of mistake of thinking that Australia was or is a Christian nation or a religious nation in some sort of fundamental sense. And it sounds like maybe the truth is it's much more complex, and we can't simply boil it down to it's either a secular nation or a Christian nation or a religious nation. It's somewhere maybe in a muddled middle there.
That's right. And I think the reference to rights is an important one, because, you know, the reality is Australians don't have many very clearly defined rights. Mm. We have some more sort of negatively defined protections, I guess I would say, protections against certain encroachments. But that's a slightly different thing from these very positively defined rights. And absolutely, that is where part of our current tension and controversy comes from.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about religion in the colonial era. I noticed in the title of your article, you quote someone who said it was the most godless place under heaven. What did that person mean by it?
It's a quote that religious historians love, and when I went to track it down, it's actually quite hard to find who said it, but it seems to have been a visiting preacher from the US in Australia around the turn of the century. But it's often used as a kind of shorthand for a long tradition of alarm and critique from religious elites, and elites in general, about the lack of Christian morality and Christian adherence amongst the colonial population, the white population as a whole. So it's, I suppose, often tied to concerns about church attendance, but it's also tied to things like people working or partying on the Sabbath, on a Sunday, people cohabiting before marriage, which was particularly common in the kind of convict population, the convict era, people not knowing their Bible, not reading their Bible. So it's often used, there's a long history, a long tradition for, particularly in the early colonial period, but continuing as that quote shows, about this apparent lack of Christian belief and morality in the general population. I think that captures a certain reality, and it obviously, if you think about, particularly in the early colonial period, the sections of British society who were coming over here, the urban poor who made up a large number of the convicts, they obviously back in Britain weren't going to church very often. They certainly weren't keen about it here, although in fact, in some cases they were forced to go. But clearly I think you can see some grounds for why religious elites might have those concerns. But I think historians do really debate this, because if you look a bit deeper at the daily lives, the ordinary lives of white colonists, I think there's also plenty of evidence that religion did matter to them. For example, there's some really fantastic work on convict tattoos. Mm. And convicts were, you know, incredibly tattooed, and their tattoos were recorded in the paperwork about them. Simon Bernard wrote a fantastic book about these tattoos, and many, many convicts tattooed themselves with religious symbols, crosses, Bible verses, you know, images of Jesus, images of the Virgin Mary. Obviously, that was because those symbols meant something to them. So even amongst groups of people that might have been identified as really irreligious, really immoral, I think we want to be careful in just accepting the judgment that religion didn't matter to them.
Okay, that's fascinating, because I think I probably was under the misapprehension that religion was more important to elites, and that the convict population and sort of others of a lower social class would have had less affiliation or given religious attendance or things like that, less value and sort of in a class distinction way. But it sounds like it was much more, it wasn't as clear in that way, I guess. So that's really interesting to hear. Mm. How did things change, or how did things change by the time, you know, jumping forward a long ways to the Federation era, when we know the Australian Constitution is being drafted and debated and eventually comes into force in 1901? Is it a similar sort of situation, or is Australia seen as a more godly country by outsiders? Do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, well, as I said, that quote about Australia being the most godless place under heaven actually does come from that period, from the late 19th century. So there's certainly that criticism endures. And there was, particularly in the 1870s, really leading up to those debates when Federation kind of became a live, really live question, there were anxieties about falling church attendance, which does seem to have have occurred. There was also the rise of self-consciously identified Christian progressives, drawing on new strands of biblical criticism in Europe, and, you know, very crudely speaking, churches or clergy individuals who were really less interested in getting people to heaven and more interested in changing society. Mm. And that was particularly the case amongst the elites. So you get this, I suppose, self-consciously progressive, self-consciously liberal stream amongst elites in some of the theological colleges, amongst some of the political leaders, you know, people like Alfred Deakin himself, who has a kind of somewhat alternative religious path. These things are gaining strength, and that also creates anxiety amongst some Christian elites, but of course is also a form of religious adherence. So I think at the time of Federation, if you look at the debates amongst politicians, there is certainly a general sense that Christianity, or at least religion in general, is a necessary part of a good society. And that's an idea that elites throughout the 19th century generally held to, that Christianity or religion, at least some form of religion, is the basis of public order, of social order. And that idea is there, you know, way back when Arthur Phillip plants the flag and you know, articulates the need for Christian morality to help the convicts reform. Mm-hmm. And I think it's there at Federation when people like Deakin, who are not traditional Christians in any sense, are certainly allying the idea of Christianity, very broadly conceived, with public morality, social order, those kinds of things. So it's not, there's no, I think, equivalent to, again, the American idea of a chosen nation. There's not that kind of religious fervor in Australian nationalism at the time of Federation. But I think there is this kind of muted general acceptance that Christianity needs to be part, or religion needs to be part of the package for a good nation.
That makes sense. And does that then tie into the White Australia policy? What would become the stolen generations? The idea of, as you say, Christianity as sort of underpinning public morality, order. Does that all connect in a way?
Absolutely. I think in terms of the White Australia policy, it's perhaps a little... it's a little bit around the other way. The White Australia policy indirectly, well, directly privileges Christianity. I think in the White Australia policy, there is an underlying assumption that Christianity and whiteness are sort of naturally connected. But the White Australia policy is not really about religion, and that's not really part of the debate about it. But the consequence of it is that religions other than Christianity, which absolutely have a place in colonial society, I mean, of course, Indigenous spirituality, but there's a strong tradition of Chinese religion in the colonies. There are Jewish synagogues and meeting houses quite early on. There's mosques. So those are present there in the colonial period. But the people who make up those communities are largely discriminated against under the White Australia policy. And certainly those communities, with the exception of Jewish people, but certainly, Afghan population, Chinese population are actively restricted under the White Australia policy.
And one of the things I think that I found very insightful about your article is you mention, you quote Carolyn Evans' statement that religion in Australian history is determined much more by politics, or shaped by politics, much more than law. And coming from the US, it may be, there's a lot of legal influence on religion and vice versa. But why is the situation different in Australia, and how, why is it more politics than law when it comes to religion in Australia?
So I think what often happens in Australia is that because there are fairly relatively broad legal parameters in which religious institutions and the state can interact, because all of that is a bit broad and deliberately broad and amorphous, what that has meant is that there's a lot of space for particular governments, particular churches, particular lobby groups to bring about change, which often occurs quite slowly and over time. And then the law responds to that. So sometimes, I mean, I think that's the sort of thing that we're seeing at the moment, is shifts that have been occurring over really quite a long time under different state governments, for example, as well as the federal government, come to a point where there is enough controversy that it becomes a matter that is taken to court. So just to give an example, I think perhaps the most obvious example is to do with the relationship, the role of religious institutions in the provision of welfare. And there's a lot of parallels to education, but I'll talk about welfare. So if you look back to the early colonial period, at that, when the colonial government was set up in New South Wales, the first colonial government, there was a decision made to avoid establishing the equivalent of the British poor laws, which would have provided a right to relief for Australia, for British subjects in Australia, to the colonial government. Now, overall, I think that was great because the poor laws were a disaster. But what the colonial government did instead was to encourage wealthy citizens, wealthy subjects, to establish charities, private charities, and then to basically offer to co-fund those. So what that meant was that throughout the colonial period, you saw the establishment of what some people have called a third sector of welfare in Australia, which, similar things exist in other places, but it's particularly pronounced in Australia, that you have this overlap between the state and private charities in the provision of welfare. Now, the vast majority of those private charities were and are religious in their foundation. And those societies were absolutely reliant on the voluntary labour and financial contributions that religious people provided, that members of churches provided. And that really was necessary for the effective or even sort of semi-effective provision of welfare in the colonial period. Now, in the 20th century, there's much stronger shift to a welfare state, particularly after the Second World War, you see governments really committing much more to the apparatus of a welfare state. But this third sector remains absolutely critical to that. And what we've seen, you know, over the past, say, 3 or 4 decades, is that governments, state governments, whether they are left or right wing in persuasion, have basically continued that trend for quite pragmatic reasons, really. Sometimes for ideological reasons, of course. There are politicians who, you know, would feel that religious institutions offer a better service, or that the government shouldn't be the sole provider of welfare. But mostly it's just purely pragmatic. It's the system that exists, and it's cheaper to do it this way. Now, that's not something that really has been. There are laws pertaining to those relationships, but it's much more a matter of policy. So those shifts happen slowly, but as that continues around that relationship, society changes. And that, I think, is one of the things that's creating some of the significant controversies we have at the moment, where society as a whole is becoming less Christian on a whole bunch of measures, whereas in fact the role of religious institutions in the provision of welfare and education has continued to increase. And that's, I mean, it's almost inevitable that will create conflict.
And I guess one of the controversies that maybe you're speaking of is about religious freedom, or a Commonwealth religious discrimination, religious freedom bill. Do you think the push for that comes from a fear or a perception by mainstream Christians that they're under threat or under attack, or somehow losing political power that they once had? Or is there some other cause for why there's this push now that wasn't there 30 years ago or 50 years ago or 75 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think this. I think there's a number of contributing factors. That tension that I just described between, on the one hand, on a whole range of markers, Christians make up a smaller proportion of the population and have less political influence, although clearly still an enormous amount of political influence, but less than they did. And on the other hand, this overrepresentation, you might say, in the education and health sector means that, on the side of ardent secularists, there's something terribly wrong with that picture. It gives Christians an inordinate amount of influence compared to their, the number of actual devout Christians in the country. But I think from the Christian perspective, it means that there are actually a whole lot of pointy questions that they are confronting, because religious institutions are continuing to operate as they have done, but they are facing new pressures, new regulatory frameworks, new issues and challenges that they have not been forced to deal with before. So I think that is a meaningful part of all of this, which is that there actually are a whole lot of people who run Christian schools or run Christian hospitals who are actually being forced to address matters that they haven't had to address before. I'm not particularly sympathetic to the notion that Christians face terrible persecution in Australia. I think Christian influence is decreasing. I think there is plenty of criticism of Christian beliefs and historical actions if you look at media, if you look at universities. And it's absolutely the case that a lot of Christians cannot say or do things publicly that without negative consequence that once they could have done. So the world is changing. And of course, that can feel like persecution for a group that has had power and had privilege. But I think the reaction's often completely out of proportion and often really, I suppose, clueless about the experience of marginalized people and minorities and the ways in which Christian privilege and Christian power actually impacts the lives of people of minority religions in this country, obviously LGBTQ people. I think that Christians are very clueless about the ways in which their privilege actually impacts people on a day-to-day basis.
If the current demographic trends continue, and I guess we'll find out pretty soon with the recent census about religious identity or affiliation in Australia, and it continues to decline in terms of Christians as an just bare majority right now in Australia, will that put more pressure on religious charities and I guess more pressure on the government to perhaps take up the slack of welfare support, social support services that religious charities aren't able to make? It's always hard to predict the future, but I'm trying to think through where we'll be in 10 years or 20 years. Will we look like England, where we see a lot of empty churches and, you know, very small percentages of people who formally affiliate with a religion? Or will the decline sort of halt and will maintain the status quo? Do you have any insights or predictions?
Well, I think that entanglement of the church and state in the welfare sector and in the education sector would be very long and complex to untangle. So I think regardless of your ideological convictions, it's going to be, I think, a long, complex negotiation. I don't think there's any simple answers to that, because frankly, the state is not going to take up that slack. They're going to outsource it if religious institutions or religious welfare agencies vacate that space, it will not be taken up by the state. It will be taken up by, it will be outsourced to business. And this is one of the, although I am uncomfortable, particularly in the field of education, I think with welfare, a lot of religious institutions, a lot of religious welfare agencies have actually been pretty flexible and pretty willing to comply. They generally don't see themselves as imparting Christian values in the work they do. Whereas I think schools are much more of a hot topic for lots of reasons, because it's kids, because the role of the adults in that section, in that the Christians in that context, is to impart Christian values. So it's a slightly different situation. But I think people who are hardline secularists should be really aware that in the context of welfare, if you want religion to get out of welfare, you need to be realistic about the fact that it is going to be the private sector, not the state, you know, barring revolution and, you know, full Marxist takeover. I don't think, you know, I don't think we are going back to, you know, some kind of post-war British welfare state. So I don't think people like that answer. I don't think anybody likes that answer, really. But that, I think, is the reality.
The most realistic answer. Okay, yeah, that may not be one people like, but it may be the most realistic answer. In your article, you make a few suggestions for where you think Australia should head, some sort of policy changes. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about those. The first one you talk about is in reference to Indigenous spirituality and the need to better accommodate or support Indigenous spirituality. What should Australia do in that area to make things better?
In some ways, I suppose this, we haven't really talked about this very much, but to my mind, this is actually the great, this is the great ignored question, but actually probably the most critical one. And I think it illuminates the way, the very narrow understanding of religion that has been, you know, but that has shaped debates about religious freedom in Australia because of the privileged position of Christianity and the way in which religion has been defined very much on Christian terms. Now, I absolutely don't want to make a call about whether Indigenous law and philosophy and practice should be described as religion, because I know Indigenous people don't, many Indigenous people don't, they would reject that description. But I think if you're going to say that there is a category of human meaning making that demands protection because it's actually central to how people live their lives, how they find meaning, how they make connections, then Indigenous law, Indigenous philosophy, Indigenous practice absolutely fits those definitions. And it is the law of this place. So it is the, it is a religion, if we use the word religion, is the religion that arises from this place. So I think it is not, if we wanted to talk about something called Indigenous religious freedom, because it is connected to place, we have to talk about sovereignty. We have to talk about freedom to move. We have to talk about freedom to exercise custodial relationships, freedom to exercise all of those relationships that are central to Indigenous ways of being. So to me, this is the big meta question that is largely ignored, because I don't think, although, you know, the draft legislation, for example, on religious freedom and religious discrimination does mention Indigenous spirituality, the reality is the laws that would actually protect Indigenous spirituality are going to be laws to do with things, are going to be things like treaties, some people would say constitutional recognition, you know, those kinds of things that actually give priority to Indigenous sovereignty in relationship to place. Those are the things that will protect Indigenous, let's say Indigenous religious freedom. Okay. So I think that that's one of the ways in which the conversation really needs to expand beyond the terms in which it's currently being conducted.
Okay, that's very persuasive. The second suggestion you talk about is having to do with sort of social discrimination against minority religious believers. What is social discrimination as opposed to, I guess, government or state discrimination? And what are some of the challenges that minority religious believers face?
Yeah, so I use that language in the article, and I'm drawing on some categories that Jonathan Fox proposes, where he talks about different forms of discrimination, that there's state discrimination against religion, which could be state discrimination against the majority religion. And he's thinking there of contexts like France, for example, you know, with the opposition, like laws against the display of crosses, that kind of thing. State discrimination against minority religions, and again, to use the French example, you know, the banning of burqas in public in schools and things like that. But then he says there's another category of discrimination, which is social discrimination, which is the day-to-day discrimination that religious people experience on the grounds of their religion. It's not necessarily the state that's doing it. It's your fellow citizens and subjects. So, and I think, you know, all of the indicators that we have show that that is a significant problem in Australia for people, for Muslim people particularly, but for other minority religious groups as well. Things like, you know, verbal harassment, not getting jobs, getting treated differently in social situations, all those kinds of things, and all the registers that we have of Islamophobia and other forms of religious discrimination show that behaviour is alive and well and takes a really serious toll on people.
And I guess for some of that, we do have anti-discrimination laws that address some of those harmful behaviors. I guess would the rest have to come through sort of education and training in tolerance and acceptance and sort of cultural competency? Or I guess how do you suggest the policies should be changed or improved in that area?
Well, the some of the discussion on the religious discrimination legislation does include a proposal for a religious discrimination or a religious freedom commissioner. We have that for, you know, those roles in a number of other spheres. And I suppose I think that's a great idea. It means it's identifying religious discrimination as a specific category that's distinct from racial discrimination, although obviously there's a lot of overlap there, or from gender discrimination, from sexuality discrimination. It's identifying it as a specific problem, and that means it can be tracked. There can be public education programs. There can be research, you know, all those kinds of things. I think that idea of a commissioner is a terrific one, because it means there's somebody who's funded and recognised to really develop policies around this, develop education around it. So, I mean, that's only one idea, but I think it is actually one of the great suggestions in that that's in that draft legislation.
Okay. And then the third sort of policy bit you mentioned in your article is something we've talked a bit about, is the sort of entanglement, I guess, to use the US constitutional term, excessive entanglement, perhaps, between religion and the social welfare and education sectors. Are there any sort of feasible ways to disentangle these things in Australia? I'm thinking of, I guess, religious schools as one example. There was a time, decades or even a century earlier, where government funding for religious schools was very controversial or deemed very problematic. Now it's incredibly widespread. It seems to enjoy fairly high social support. It doesn't seem like that's something that it's practical to disentangle. We've talked a little bit about sort of the welfare side of things, that through a pragmatic view, the government relies upon religious groups providing charitable services, and they're not going to want to take up the slack there. What sort of improvements are feasible in the near future in this area, if any?
I do think that it is feasible to require educational institutions that take taxpayers' money to conform to widely socially accepted standards. So I think parents have rights about, I don't think everybody should be compelled to go to a state school, but I think the expectation that if a school receives tax dollars, I mean, no private school is really private. I think tightening the regulations around those schools, what they're allowed to teach, obviously, particularly around sexuality, who they're allowed to fire. I think that is appropriate, and that governments should be pretty committed to holding the line on that without saying we're going to abolish religious schools. So I think that is realistic. In some ways, it's about halting a trend rather than completely rolling back the arrangement. I think generally lobbying for, state schools as the best and most appropriate model of schooling, rather than kind of relying on a freedom of choice sort of model or rhetoric of freedom of choice is important. And I think things like the recent decision to expand, the chaplaincy, provisions, which, have been controversial for a long time. But I think expanding that to include secular youth workers is a great idea. Now, again, I think there is a reality there that people may not understand, which is that there are large numbers of religious believers who give their money and their time to make it possible for those chaplains to do their work. They're not fully government funded in most cases. And I think it's always going to be difficult to get that kind of support for secular workers. So I think there's some kind of reality about the amount of energy, time, and money that religious communities will invest in things that, again, I think that's sometimes not taken into account enough in terms of thinking, what would be an ideal situation. So it will be interesting to see how much difference that actually makes. But I think it's a good, I think it's absolutely an appropriate move.
No, I agree with you on the chaplaincy aspect. I did some research on that some years ago. I think the interesting thing is, even if the program parameters are changed to allow secular youth workers, the chaplaincy service providers, the ones who train and work with schools and actually placing chaplains, tend to be rather narrow in who they allow to be part of their service. So even if the formal requirements change, practically, I'm not sure how much that will change. And the last research I looked at, I think, showed it was something like 98% to 99% of the chaplains were Christians, even though demographically, of course, Christians are a much smaller percentage of the Australian population than that. So it will be very interesting to see whether any actual changes happen, or if the idea of chaplaincy itself, we may start to think that maybe guidance counselors or psychologists or others are actually better in schools than chaplains. I guess we'll have to wait and see on that.
And I did notice that alongside that, actually, there has been the announcement of really significant funding for mental health workers, which I think is just Victorian schools, it would be, with the aim of having a dedicated mental health worker in every Victorian school, which I think is fantastic.
Sure.
Necessary thing. So that, I suppose, is also the other the flip side is not just about what can we take away, but what can we add to create more diverse and representative environment.
Well, we had better wrap up there. I know I'm taking up a lot of your time. I really appreciate you speaking with me today. I think I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners have too.
Absolute pleasure.
And if you'd like to learn more about Drona's research, I'll put some links in the show notes. As always, if you have questions or comments about the podcast, you can email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au. Until next time, thanks for listening.